coming, last class, and especially for coming a little bit after class is technically ended. Today we're talking about eugenics, and in particular talking about sort of where a lot of the history and even some of the ethics of the history we've talked about leads to in terms of the birth of bioethics, which is what Art Kaplan is teaching next semester, but also sort of provides a good terminus for what we talked about this semester. What I'm going to have us start with is watch a short 10-minute video. It's a documentary about eugenics in Britain, in America, and in Germany. The readings I ended up giving for this week and the discussion is really about those sites as being places that we've seen of professional and sort of practical sort of importance clinically in the history of medicine, the history of Western medicine. And eugenics significantly and appropriately becomes the spot where this contentious part of the history of medicine also gets parlayed on, according a lot to cultural backgrounds, historical backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, and political ones as well. Eugenics is kind of an interesting topic, and historians of medicine love talking about it because of the fact that it's not atypical in the way that it is informed by and affected by economic, political, and cultural concerns in a particular historical moment, but the way in which it seems to galvanize so centrally at such a significant time, ways in which there's a troubling relationship with the history that we see. I mentioned that one of the hard parts about doing history of medicine is not to judge that history, and normally we're judging it at the level of, does it seem accomplished or not accomplished? Does it seem less than medicine today, or science, or technology today? Well, eugenics, not so different than, say, phrenology, what we said a couple of weeks ago, is one of those parts, chapters of the history of Western medicine that's troubling, not because we judge it just on whether it's as good or not as medicine or science today, but because it's very troubling in the kind of applications it's had and the kind of theories that are behind it, those being largely sexist, classist, racist in ways, and also anti-disabled as well. What I want to do is watch this 10-minute video, and then we're basically going to have us go through a couple of primary readings that are related to our eugenics. Everybody should have a handout, which is the kind of cover stationery for the American Eugenics Society. And on the back is one of their like case study surveys. This one is for musical ability, which we'll look at in a second to see how the charting and the statistical breakdown of eugenics science really provided for it a lot of the attractiveness of that particular science. And then I'm going to have us look at the Buck versus Bell case and a short article from the book by Degeneration, called Degeneration by Max Norda, which is sort of the cornerstone of eugenic theory. And I want us to kind of talk about what are the specific elements and variables that are involved in eugenics developing as a distinct medical scientific practice, and how is it unique to its time, and how is it rather indicative of other forms of medicine and clinical culture that we've studied this semester. I'm going to start now, I think. And the one thing I was going to mention, too, and Shelley can chime in here, too, is that there's been interest in maybe doing a field trip in January, if anybody's interested, to two places in particular. One is the Mutter Museum, which is at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, which is not far away. And the other is at the Hospital of Pennsylvania, which is the oldest hospital in the United States. Both of these are places I used to work at, actually. So if you're interested in going, then I'm going to... Shelley, can you give us your email? Because you're going to be our point lady.
Maybe what I'll do is get some times from you that would work, and then I'll email everybody, and you can indicate if you want to go.
Can I put your email on the board for now? Is that okay?
Yes.
What is it?
S. Bierenbaum. B-I-R.
B-I-R.
E-N.
E-N.
B-A-U-M.
Uh-huh.
Sympatico.
At?
At Sympatico, S-Y-M. P-A-T-I-C-O.ca.
What's Sympatico?
That's the Bell provider from Canada.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I knew it.
Nobody knows in here.
Anyway, for now, though, if you're interested in going, we're going to figure out dates and stuff at some point. But if you haven't been to the Mutter Museum, or if you haven't been to the Hospital of Pennsylvania, or you have, the great thing about going is the fact that what might be interesting after having done this course together is to see not just how central Philadelphia and these institutions are, but really how these are places that almost are like stepping into a part of that medical history. And just to give you two examples, at the Hospital of Pennsylvania, what's interesting there is one of the most attractive things is its anatomical theater, which is very famous for the fact that there are a lot of autopsies and also surgeries performed there for mostly for the consumption of medical students, but actually to be in that space and to really witness not just how tutelage and pedagogy worked at that time, but really to feel the theatricality that was involved in the performance of that kind of learning of medical science. So that's one interesting there. And at the Mutter Museum, everybody's heard about all kinds of crazy stuff they have there, but one of the most fascinating things, and I tell this all the time because I worked there for like 2 years doing exhibits and stuff, is that people go and they see stuff and they either think, you know, it's as gross as you said it was, or it's as crazy as you said it was, or that kind of stuff. But one response is often it's a lot smaller than I thought it was going to be. It's basically about 4, 5, 6 rooms. whole bunch of shit shoved in there, you know? And the point of it is this, if you're interested, is that the point of it is to feel as though you're stepping into a medical educational textbook almost. So rather than going to a traditional museum where there's a couple of pieces or pieces that are portrayed or displayed prominently, individually, to go to a museum like the Mütter Museum is to go and see lots of things clustered close together. Because the point is comparison and contrast. So rather than seeing the unique skulls or skeletons of a couple of individuals, you'll walk into a room and there'll be hundreds on a wall. Because you're walking in and literally trying to learn in that space by comparing the actual documents, texts, archival, ephemeral sort of things that are there. So just to go and witness these spaces is in some ways part of the experience. And if we do, can organize something to go, would you like to show me, then I'll come with and talk about things.
So let me know if you're interested.
Yeah, totally. So anyway, but I'll send out an email about that later. But anyway, so this is a short documentary that's about eugenics. It's going to cover Germany, Britain, and the United States, like I said. And then we're going to take it from here and sort of segue into looking at some of the documents that are spoken about in this film. Any questions before we start? All right. Tula? Mm-hmm.
At the turn of the 20th century, rapid industrialization and urbanization led to a social upheaval, defined by goals for a civilization free of violence, disease, and mental ailments. However, the means by which this utopian society would be attempted would include some of the most profound ethical violations in the history of the United States.
Precedent was behind it, liberals were behind it, conservatives were behind it, even the Catholic Church at one point was behind it.
Intense growth of American industry, agricultural mechanization, and widespread immigration led to the first major migration away from the farms and into the city, which is now expanding faster than adequate housing could be provided. The solution to the modern problems of an industrialized society required increased government involvement in the social sphere, a philosophy known as progressivism. The construct of scientific management offered a methodical means of social engineering. Geneticists of the age would prove through the use of human pedigrees and their knowledge of plant and animal genetics that degeneracy was an inheritable trait. It seemed only right that if a society free of all mental and physical ailments, free of violence and crime, illiteracy and foolishness, it seemed only right to end the reproductive capabilities of people expressing these traits. Eugenics was the result of an America unwilling to make social changes, an upper class fearful of its laboring counterparts. Eugenics placed the blame of a social quandary on individual races and classes, and thus freed from culpability the industrial, scientific, and political barons of the time. Cold Spring Harbor, New York, 1910. Charles B. Davenport, along with Harry H. Laughlin, both biologists and members of the American Breeders Association, found the Eugenics Record Office with financial help from the Carnegie Institution. The ERO would be the headquarters of eugenic research in the United States for the next 34 years. Using various research methods, including human pedigrees, hereditary questionnaires, interviewing groups of special interest, such as circus performers, and collecting census data, the ERO was able to justify the administration of eugenic laws nationwide, including immigration and marriage restrictions, race segregation, and forced sterilization of criminals and other undesirables. The ERO, however, was not only able to justify the eugenics atrocities, but integrated them into popular culture to make eugenics and related terms, such as race hygiene, household words. Popular literature published in the 20s often donned eugenics in their subject matter, such as these manuals on raising a healthy family. Clergymen preached of the necessity for good marriages. Perhaps even more disturbing were the contests held at many state fairs, where awards were given to the fittest family, those with the purest pedigrees, and undoubtedly the most attractive phenotypes would receive awards, such as this medal with an inscription reading, "Yay, I have a goodly heritage."
The eugenics movement spawned lots of people who were considered, even in their own time, out on the fringe, who even endorsed such things as euthanasia. But that was not a mainline part of the movement. It certainly became parts of the movement internationally, but not so much here in America.
On March 9, 1907, the Indiana State Senate, in a vote of 28-16, made history by being the first jurisdiction in the world to force the sterilization of citizens it deemed unfit. Unfit to exist, unfit to reproduce. Connecticut was soon to follow. By the time Laughlin of the ERO had published his suggestion on how to implement legislation for forced human sterilization, 12 states had already put into place sterilization laws of their own. By 1924, 3,000 socially inadequate people had been sterilized. That same year, based on Laughlin's model, Aubrey E. Strode drafted Virginia's Eugenical Sterilization Act in an attempt to rid the state of defective persons. It passed in Virginia's General Assembly by a landslide. Immediately, the Virginia Colony for the Epileptic and Feeble-Minded selected 17-year-old Carrie Buck to be the first human sterilized under the act. Carrie had a feeble-minded child, the result of a raping by one of her relatives, and was daughter of a feeble-minded mother, Emma, already arrested on the Virginia Colony. Carrie, purportedly carrying the genetic traits of feeble-mindedness and sexual promiscuity, was a fine candidate, as the law stated those to be sterilized must be probable potential parents of socially inadequate offspring. Carrie's feeble-mindedness was based on a male disposition by Laughlin, who had never met Carrie, and her sexual promiscuity was based on the testimony of her school teacher that she sent flirtatious notes to schoolboys. Carrie became the first person in Virginia to be sterilized under the new law on October 19, 1927. In the words of Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, official deliverer of the opinion of the United States Supreme Court in the case of Buck v. Bell, "It is better for all of the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their crime. Three generations of imbeciles are enough." Vivian, Carrie's feeble-minded daughter, received fees on her first grade report card. Buck v. Bell justified the sterilizations of over 8,000 Virginians. Over the history of the United States, 33 states have enacted statutes under which 16,000 Americans underwent compulsory sterilizations. To this day, Buck v. Bell has never been overruled.
Nazi Germany embraced the eugenics movement from the United States and just upped it in its efficiency.
It should now be apparent that Germany's racial theories did not take place in a vacuum, nor can the fundamental philosophies and beliefs that would eventually lead to the atrocities of the Nazi state be attributed solely to German authorities. In fact, German scientists expressed a great affinity towards U.S. eugenic laws. A young Adolf Hitler wrote positively of the U.S.'s immigration restrictions, more specifically how the law refuses immigration on principle by simply excluding certain races from naturalization, in his book Mein Kampf. Shortly prior to mobilizing the most comprehensive eugenics legislation in modern history, Gerhard Wagner, head of the National Socialist Position League, stated that America's eugenic policies should be used as a model for Germany to follow. Marie Kopp of the American Committee on Maternal Health proclaimed that the Nazi system of seeking out those to be sterilized was administered in entire fairness and was formulated after careful study of the California experiment, which had been responsible for 2,500 of the 3,000 involuntary sterilizations in the U.S. prior to 1924. The ERO boasted on how the German statute on race hygiene read almost identical to Laughlin's model sterilization law. Laughlin had such a significant impact on Nazi racial legislature that he was awarded an honorary degree from the University of Heidelberg. Laughlin thanked the university for reaffirming the common understanding of German and American scientists of the nature of eugenics. This common understanding would be translated into the law on preventing hereditarily ill progeny, which would be responsible for over 375,000 sterilizations in the Nazi state. A number so impressive, one American eugenics advocate complained, "The Germans are beating us at our own game." The sterilization program of the Nazi state, modeled after Laughlin's law and other U.S. eugenic theories, would be a gross prelude to the exterminations of the Holocaust. But even before the gas chambers were opened for the racist and anti-Semitic persecutions we know all too well, they were opened in October 1939 for the systematic murder of the mentally ill citizens of Germany. Sadly, this practice was not faced with nearly as much stigmatism within the states, as euthanasia had long been discussed by American eugenicists as a solution for the feeble-minded.
So when people saw how eugenics can easily be abused, but our they said, "That's it, this is a monstrous idea that we should keep a distance from."
It is now the dawn of the 21st century, and advancements in technology and medicine have excelled beyond even the most ambitious of projections. Science that eugenicists of the 20th century could only have dreamed of appear in our news every single day.
Of stem cell research
and picking the genomes of our children.
Cloning of embryos for their destruction.
We discovered stem cells in a new place.
Is it a danger? It's always a danger when there are technologies that can be used and abused. And I think that the history of the eugenics movement tells us when a technology actually exists, people will try to use it, sometimes for reasons it was never intended to be used.
With the mapping of the human genome, prenatal testing, implantation genetic diagnosis, therapeutic cloning, and stem cell therapy, we find ourselves entering a promising world of genetic medicine. It is with this great power, however, that comes the need for even greater responsibility, sensitivity, and accountability.
Humanity truly does now possess a powerful tool for good. However, we must heed the warning sounded by the coercive legislation and beliefs of the eugenics movement before we may venture into the frontier of modern genetic medicine. Tragedy may very well give way to triumph, but how that will be recorded in the history books of tomorrow will be determined by our actions today.
The lights for me? All right, let's shut this down. Okay, what I'd like to start with then is if you could pull out that sheet that I gave everybody. This is just the cover of Eugenics Society. I want you to have that out in front of you. And if you could pull out, if you have a copy of the Galton piece, which is titled From the American Journal of Sociology. I'd like to have a start by looking at what is essentially one of his sort of like mission statements, if you will, about what is eugenics supposed to do and what is it going to provide. Before looking more closely at this particular document, this one by Galton, I'd like to sort of break down for you what is significant about eugenics and different disciplines that it spoke to and attracted. Thus, this handout I gave you with the tree on the top, its emblem for the American Eugenics Society, or the Breeder Society sometimes it's called, was this image, as you can see, of eugenics as this fruitful tree at the top. And what's underneath it are all these other disciplines that are informing. And as we can see here, those are anatomy, biology, physiology, genetics, psychology, anthropology, I'm just jumping around, history, law, politics, economics, religion, medicine, surgery. As we've noticed, that history of medicine as it's progressed, especially from the 18th through the 20th century, has been about greater specialization, but also greater integration of different specialties in a way that becomes to see them all as worthy of proper training and also proper scrutiny and proper experimental and scientific method as well. Now, eugenics, we have to understand, and why it's an interesting subject, is not just the way it was applied towards such races or classes or even sort of like Holocaust kind of ends, but the way in which that it really spoke to it was very attractive as a science and a medicine, because it spoke to so many of the things that we saw as being quite progressive at that time, the 19th until the 20th centuries, for what had been a great discipline. So to that end, I would sort of outline for you and have you take note of what I see are sort of the major influences that made possible eugenics as a discipline. One of these historically, is industrialism. Now, it sounds like that seems to be a bit off-kilter, but the point of why it influences is that there's such a greater impetus post-industrial revolution, in particular after the 18th century, to start thinking about what is the most efficacious way to organize a society, the most efficacious way to have businesses, culture, populations, training, and to that degree family planning as a part of that, for the benefit of a particular society and culture. That is one that's about efficacy, but it's also one that's about efficiency at the same time. To that end, there becomes a kind of model to want to think about industrial productivity as it's applied also towards biology as well. The point being that eugenics would not be possible but for an age post-industrial, one out of need and necessity, but also out of worldview, a tendency to take a kind of scrutiny that is applied to economics and politics and business and applying it now towards biology, and in this case, family planning. So industrialism is one of those first ones. The second one that's almost contemporaneous with it is Darwinism. So our idea of trying to think about biological Darwinism, and then its later translation to social Darwinism. This idea of thinking about not just survival of the fittest, as we call it, but a notion of the fittest altogether. This idea that there can be, either through genetics or biology, or somehow through history, a way with which we can demarcate between who is fit and who is not fit. Darwin and his theories in trying to understand survival of species, as he calls them, is trying to think about who was best equipped to live the long life, to fight the long fight, if you will, to last out over generations and over time. In his case, he's thinking about species, but that kind of logic gets applied as well to economic models, political models, and even biological ones. So that ability to take that framework and apply it as it is here towards biology is one of the key features. Yeah, Joy?
Will you deal as well if there were tensions against this movement at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, there were plenty of them too. What I wanted to focus on first is just what's not just attractive, but what also laid the groundwork for the very birth of this discipline. After all, I think it's not hard for us to notice some of the things that are problematic about eugenics. Therefore, one of the leaps is to try to think about how could this discipline have seemed not only not problematic, but actually incredibly attractive in terms of some of the features that it had. So Darwinism is the second one I wanted to list. A third is, as an offshoot too, is just the birth of this field of genetics, this idea of thinking about the passing on of traits, both in a larger sort of human population sense, but also in a very specific case-by-case sort of study. To that end, a fourth one that's significant for us then is the very notion of prenatal care or medicine. Now, there have been forms of prenatal care for quite some time, going all the way back to classical medicine, this idea of wanting to see a clinician or wanting to see a health practitioner when one is pregnant or when one is infertile, for example, and those kinds of remedies. But the notion of it as a distinct discipline, so the rise of the OB-GYN sort of profession in the late 19th century really made possible also this idea of demarcating a prenatal necessity for healthcare. And the truth is, eugenics, as it was first fashioned, actually meant anything that dealt with prenatal care, whether that's having to go see an OB-GYN person, whether that's having to think about your diet when you're pregnant, whether that's having to think about your fertility, whether that's thinking about what to do if you have a miscarriage, and also how do you deal with the question of family planning more generally, not just in the specific of how do you conceive, but also how do you preserve your own health and think about your own lineage or stock, if you will, in the larger questions. So the creation of eugenics really comes from this specialty of thinking about the health and the welfare of future populations, whether they be in utero or whether they be in the future down the road. To that degree, I also just want to stress that the creation of eugenics, which has such a lingering, sort of like icky, sort of like lasting flavor to us now, at the time felt very forward-looking and also quite innocent in the way that it was trying to pay attention to the future possibility of having children and preserving the quality of those children as they could be born. To that end, if eugenics seemed to be about eradicating certain parts of populations, where it eventually went towards, its actual nascence was about trying to preserve the quality of any kind of life that could come in the future by improving neonatal and prenatal sort of care. So that discipline is a significant one. The next one that we're going to talk about in a bit is this notion of degeneration theory, which we started to talk about when we talked about phrenology, but about this idea, if Darwinism gives us the fittest notion, degeneration thinks about how can we think about certain types, populations, propensities that people have that render them the least desirables, so to speak, in a culture and a society. And given the way in which we're based on the Industrial Revolution, trying to think how to best maximize our resources, as we're going to find with the Buckduff versus Bell case, is there a way, prenatal, genetically, bearing in mind Darwinism, that we can attend to the kinds of persons when they're young or before they're even born, so we don't have to deal with them later down the road because we think they're going to turn out to be imbeciles or criminals or rapists or people who are shiftless, for example, some undesirable category. And that notion of undesirable shifts from different cultures and times and societies. So degeneration theory provides a way not just to quantify, as phrenology did, and not to isolate, as phrenology did, but also to hopefully prevent even the further proliferation of those particular populations and types of persons. So degeneration theory is going to be big. That's where we're going to look at some of the language that's in there. The next thing I would say is the movement of progressivism, which is actually a large 19th century and early 20th century movement when we were talking about phrenology and we were talking about a couple of other disciplines in the 19th century, we noted that, as it was in the 19th century, it was an age with which science could do its best part, not just to become, or medicine could do its best part, not just to become scientific, but also to be applicable and hopefully beneficial towards the betterment of culture and the human race. Progressivism was a large political and social and economic movement in Western Europe and very much in the United States, where a kind of democratic spirit was very much galvanizing, especially post-Civil War in the United States, to try to think, how can we reform, is the big word here, reform culture in some way. To that end, eugenics becomes attractive because of the way in which it seems to be the perfect opportunity to put into practice, via science, a lot of the very reforms that were so central to progressivism. Those progressive movements being largely economic improvement, social improvement, industrial improvement, political improvement, and as we'll later find, eugenics is the basic genetic equivalent of progressivism at its time. So my point again is to show that eugenics is significant because not only is it not atypical for its time, but it becomes so attractive because it seems to be a quantifiable, scientifically based form and application of improving a whole host of other forms of the spirits of the age, progressively, and also in terms of improving the reform of its time. Any questions? I got two more to throw up here. Okay. So after progressivism, I would say it would be this field. This might actually be my last one here. We talked about it a couple weeks ago, of public health. Eugenics, although it seems genetically based, statistically based, scientifically based, which it absolutely is, and this is part of what made it attractive, its emphasis on statistics and quantifiables, and therefore rendering a medical, clinical sort of discipline more scientific in some way. The fostering of public health, the very consideration of what's the best for the common good, also makes possible eugenics as a significantly attractive field. I think I mentioned to you, was it last week or 2 weeks ago that we did this large public health lecture? 2 weeks ago? Yeah. But that all of the things that seemed to be of the spirit of the 19th century, public health was so attractive too, because of the way that it was empirical and scientific and quantifiable and statistical and applicable and provided reform. So public health explodes in the 19th century, not just because the infrastructure is there to make it possible, but all of the spirits and the values that are so significant at that time in medicine and science and outside of it render public health so attractive. Eugenics comes in at the end of that century, in the beginning of the 20th century, as perhaps maybe the best way to put public health into practice. So we aren't cleaning up problems down the road, but actually preventing them in some way before they even happen. Of course, what will ultimately be the hard part about eugenics, and the part that actually renders it to be the biased science that it was that as good as science and medicine are, and even today when we have great genetic testing, we have the Human Genome Project at work, we also know that science and medicine can't be 100% predictive either. I'll just throw out meteorology as an example, right? I mean, it's this idea that we can get more and more and more precise in terms of how we can predict certain markers and certain characteristics, but the inability to be 100% accurate also means that the kind of judgments we make now, making a judgment like a meteorologist about whether it's going to rain next Tuesday, we can get more precise about, but morally, ethically, it's not going to be too loaded. But whether or not I can determine your child is going to be a criminal and whether or not we should exterminate that child or prevent it from being conceived, suddenly the ethics in the world are that much more exaggerated. Yeah?
I just had a quick question about the film. The woman that they spoke about that was the first person sterilized in Virginia, and then they talked about her child, were they saying her child was feeble-minded as well, and then they said she got Bs as a point to that she wasn't actually that feeble-minded, or is B, I don't know, maybe it's pen, but like, is B good or bad?
Well, yeah, I mean,
sorry.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't know.
B is good in the old days.
I think nowhere you go, what, even if B is bad at pen, I don't think it would be enough to warn that you should have been sterilized. If you had a B, they should have never had you.
Yeah. You know? I didn't know what they were, my point was. Yeah.
Even in a world of great, great inflation, I don't think it's that bad. Yeah, but I mean, but the point is that there were signs and symptoms that they thought she could have a feeble-minded child, and that when she did have one, they thought it was feeble-minded.
But actually,
they find that maybe it wasn't. Yeah, exactly. So that very nebulous sort of way with which to prescribe. If you could pull out the Galton article, I want us to look at a couple of things in there real quick. So anyway, I throw this out there, and that's a lot of big umbrella terms up here, but why I do that is to show that eugenics was not made possible by a few Nazis at a certain time that thought it sounded attractive to apply their racist theories. even though it was. And it wasn't just attractive to a bunch of people who were racist in the South in America who didn't want interracial marriages, even though it did do that, but that it actually had attractive qualities that spoke to a whole range of persons in a whole bunch of different disciplines. In fact, it's something that's mentioned in this article, the one on eugenics in Britain by Donald McKenzie. He has a section where he lists who the lead people were in a particular eugenics movement. It's on page 504, and it's doctors and lawyers and politicians and scientists and writers and clergymen and headmasters, and which is not to say that all those professions and all those people were supportive of eugenics, but that they could be, that there's a way in which this discipline, as potentially polarizing as it seems, as much of a lightning rod as eugenics seems, that actually was a uniter in some ways of across different disciplines. Yeah?
Quick question. At the beginning of the film, they mentioned quickly that industrialism and urbanization, they mentioned.
Yeah.
Urbanization under the industrialism.
I would. And the reason those two are mentioned in that is because there was a mindset to start to think about how many resources do we have to apply to how many people. It's the same reason that when we started talking about Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year, which dated from about 400 years before this, and I started to say, we're seeing grumblings here of public health before it's actually started. Because the reason was we had a whole bunch of people in a tight space with only a certain amount of resources, so what can we do? And so it seems like supply and demand, as much as survival of the fittest, seem to be two factors that work in tandem. So the invocation of urbanism in that documentary plays into what industrialism has wrought, which is a whole bunch of people coming together and living close together. Yeah, Dick.
You talk about the broad appeal, but I wonder, did this have any attraction to the proletariat? Because all these guys are really bourgeois or elite classes, and it seems that they're always looking down on other people saying, no, they're not that good.
Well, that's actually, before we look at Galton's thing, let's take out this article on eugenics in Britain, because the bar graph that's in it is a perfect sort of explanation for that view. This is on page 514. It's a line graph of the bell curve. This one here. So this bell curve that you can see here is supposed to describe what the breakdown of the British population would be. And in fact, if I could have you just take note, one of the major paragraphs to pull from this article is on page 501. It's the second full paragraph. So if you just want to write 501, I'll read it out loud right now, because what it is trying to provide for us, this paragraph, what this article really does, it shows us what's distinct about British form of eugenics, which is where Galton was from. This paragraph reads, "No attempt will be made to compare the eugenic movements of different societies. The analysis offered here is particular to the British situation. Only its general assumptions and perspectives could be applied in other contexts." And this is the point. British eugenics was unique in many respects. In particular, it was a class rather than a racist phenomenon. And unlike its German and United States equivalents, is not to be understood in terms of preoccupation with Jews, blacks, or immigrants. Doubtless British eugenicists, like Britons in general at the time, held racist views, but these proved largely incidental to their eugenic concerns. Now, on the one hand, this author, McKenzie, is a little bit naive, I think, in assuming that there isn't a racist or even a sexist or even a particular kind of anti-Semitic sort of influence to some of the policies that were happening in Britain. But given how significant and valuable and central class structure is and was to Britain at the time, it was the galvanizing discourse that was used to describe the value of eugenics sort of populations and eugenics sort of theory. What's significant about that is that eugenics has mobility between nations, but what constitutes its notions of fittest and deserving and degenerate change based on what's valuable or unvaluable to that society and that culture in general outside of science and medicine. So in Britain, it's class. In Germany, it's Semitic or anti-Semitic. In the United States, it's usually race-based. And in all of them, it's sometimes related towards disability as well, because it becomes a very literal way to think about whether one is fit or not fit, for if not procreation, for contribution. And you should start to see here, as we saw about discourse about madness in the 18th century that Foucault had us talk about, how we deemed persons as insane had a lot to do not just about whether they seemed to have reason or not, logic or not, but whether or not they actually were contributing or not to society. The economic value of each individual can't be underestimated in these moments. In the 18th century, it's the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, so suddenly we're starting to give a shit whether somebody's shiftless and feeble-minded, because of the fact that we want everybody to contribute economically and socially. And at the 20th century, the dawn of it, where industrialism has certainly not become only exploded but become the norm, we're also wondering whether people are contributing to the resources of a nation or sapping from them in some way. Yeah.
Is that why you see some of these fittest family things at like farm fairs? Well, because they're contributing their labor?
Like, the fact that was talked about at the beginning of this?
Yeah.
In some ways, productivity would be a central value that would have spoke to fittest. But don't be fooled that some of these also had shiniest hair and bluest eyes right. and shit like that, too. And I'm sure the criteria for the Oakland State Fair may have differed from the one from Indiana, so to speak, you know? But productivity, contribution, and of course, financial sustainability would have been, if not a central value or a prerequisite, might be a better way to put it, so to speak, you know? You come up, how many children? Are you still married? Are you employed? You know, I would imagine that that would be something that wouldn't qualify you. But looking at this bell curve here that's on page 514, and this is the British one that's provided here by McKenzie, and this will speak to your question, Dick, if I went the proletariat belt. Here, this is broken down. As you can see, it's a chart that works from left to right, depending upon the increased value of genetic worth, it's called here. Now, this bell curve here provides for us in the middle the respectable working class. To the left of it, the poor and low paid, one could say the less respectable working class, and all the way to the left, the lowest value, criminals, paupers, and here it says et cetera, but I think we could all fill in some qualities that fit in the et cetera, whether that's feeble-mindedness, mental retardation, or even sort of like sexual degeneracy would have been a category where that would have fallen into. Moving to the right of the center of the bell graph, though, we have skilled workers, so most respectable working class, or accomplished or trained artisanal sort of working class. And then lastly, on the far right, independent professionals, large employers, etc. Now, one thing to note about this is that there's two forms of value that are happening here. Frequency on the left, as we can see, going up on the graph, and then on the right, genetic worth. What would have been attractive to the proletariat would have been the acknowledgement of this science that you are the most large and the most significant part of the population, you of the respectable working class. And it would have been of the knowledge that then there must be a very large definition of what constitutes respectable then. So if the bell curve that is this, the cornerstone of the science is supposed to work, then the middle class and the respectable middle class isn't an elite subset within that small middle portion of socioeconomic sort of value, but actually the constitutive large core. And the point then is being that one is always striving to try to get as high up as you can within that particular form of respectable to some degree. And therefore, it's absolutely attractive form of science to people who are on the far right of this graph, because they're the ones that are the elite, the gifted, the chosen, if you will. But it makes that much more likely for everybody to want to isolate who are the persons on the left. And the promise of eugenics is this. It's that if you can take this bell curve, and you can take this lowest portion here, and in some way prevent it from happening in some way, it's not that the lowest will change to being this, but it's in some way that we can maybe raise the quality, the genetic worth of this entire part. It's this set that's pulling us all down, if you will, to some degree. So the attractiveness to the proletariat would have been that we already are seeing you as respectable, and especially because of your large numbers and you are the largest part of the population, but that we want to make you even more respectable if we can also get rid of people that are very obviously not of this particular set, whether because of ability or mental status or sexual status or race or ethnicity to some degree. Yeah.
That was one part of the Galton piece that confused me, was he seemed to think, or at one line seemed to say, as soon as we get rid of this section, this lowest denominator,
yeah.
Then we're done and we let everybody, you know, flourish the way they would normally
yeah.
improve everything.
Right.
And I was assuming that it was more of a continuous improvement versus a one-and-done thing.
Yeah, well, let's take a look at that prose, actually. It's at the very beginning of this piece from the American Journal of Sociology, Eugenics, Its Definition, Scope, and Aims. This piece from Francis Galton, these are his dates, 1822 to 1911. Hugely influenced by Darwinism, but also hugely influenced because he was trained as an economist as well by the needs of this particular post-industrial sort of society. So to that degree, he's really using the science that would have influenced him and trying to wed it with the economic values that really would have been at the core of his particular value set. I'd like us to kind of read through the first two paragraphs in this, which is really kind of a mission statement of Galton's, to speak to some of these concerns and these questions, but also this agenda that this discipline might have. Can I get somebody to volunteer to read the first paragraph, and then, well, how about the first and the second?
Eugenics is a science which deals with all influences that improve the inborn qualities of a race, also with those that develop them to the utmost advantage. The improvement of the inborn qualities or stock of some one human population will alone be discussed here. What is meant by improvement? What by the syllable you in eugenics, whose English equivalent is good? There is considerable difference between goodness in the several qualities and in that of the character as a whole. The character depends largely on the proportion between qualities, whose balance may be much influenced by education. We must therefore leave morals as far as possible out of the discussion, not entangling ourselves with the almost hopeless difficulties they raise as to whether a character as a whole is good or bad. Moreover, the goodness or badness of character is not absolute, but relative to the current form of civilization. A fable will best explain what is meant. Let the scene be the zoological gardens in the quiet hours of the night, and suppose that as in old fables the animals are able to converse, and that some very wise creature who had easy access to all the cages, say a philosophic sparrow or rat, was engaged in collecting the opinions of all sorts of animals with the view of elaborating a system of absolute morality. Going?
Yes,
mm-hmm. It is needless to enlarge on the contrariety of ideals between the beasts that prey and those they prey upon, between those and the animals that have to work hard for their food and the sedentary parasites that cling to their bodies and suck their blood, and so forth. A large number of suffrages in favor of maternal affection would be obtained, but most species of fish would repudiate it, while among the voices of birds would be heard the musical protest of the cuckoo. Though no agreement could be reached as to absolute morality, the essentials of eugenics may be easily defined. All creatures would agree that it was better to be healthy than sick, vigorous than weak, well-fitted than ill-fitted for their part in life. In short, that it was better to be good rather than bad specimens of their kind, whatever that kind might be. So with men, there are a vast number of conflicting ideals, of alternative characters, of incompatible civilizations, but they are wanted to give fullness and interest to life. Society would be very dull if every man resembled the highest estimable Marcus Aurelius or Adam Bede. The aim of eugenics is to represent each class or sect by its best specimens. That done, to lead them to work out their common civilization in their own way.
Now, this is the what you were talking about, the fact that you once bested or once improved in some way that the procreation would be left towards the species itself. Let's take a look at some of the language in this document, because I think it will help us to recognize what is the methodology behind eugenics, but also what's the problematic sort of like philosophy behind it. So looking on the first paragraph, it's very short, two-sentence paragraph. Eugenics is the science, and let's circle the key terms here, science which deals with all influences that improve the inborn, big word here, qualities of race, also with those that develop them to the utmost advantage. And probably those terms develop an advantage would be significant. Now, the fact that it gets to be a science and it uses a scientific method is absolutely what makes eugenics not just possible, but makes it proliferate in a lot of different ways at this time, as we've mentioned. What's also interesting is that this question of inborn qualities, and as it's stated here as race, now that term race has actually a rather loose sort of definition, because it can mean, in the literal sense that we understand it, skin color or ethnicity, if you will, to some degree, but it also can mean races in terms of what kind of categories, what kind of traits can you pass on. So there is a race of feeble-mindedness, or there is a race of criminal behavior. Degenerate theory would have us believe that there are a whole host of other racial categorizers besides external anatomy, or skin color, or the slope of one's brow, or the size of one's chin, or any of those sort of particular genetic features. So it's this way about trying to think about, this notion of trying to understand what is inborn and what is racial, and how science can intervene, not just to quantify and categorize those things, but absolutely manipulate them, if you will, to some degree. Now, the big term that's been provided here is what is this meant by improvement? Eugenics meaning, as the term is broken down for us etymologically here, good genes, basically, is what it means. What's provided here, if you notice, in the fourth line of the second paragraph is the character depends largely on the proportion between qualities, whose balance may be much influenced by education. That word proportion is italicized, I think, because there's in some ways, and this is a mission statement by Galton's where I think he's providing truthfully one of the core values of his discipline, but also trying to spin them in a way that's most digestible to an audience. that there is no obvious attempt to eradicate, but rather to put into balance, to in some way render more proportionate, if you will, the desirable versus its undesirable presence in the genetic pool at large. Now, what did you make of this sort of like anecdote that he provides, of the going to the zoological gardens and witnessing all of the species, from prey to those who are subject to prey, to sedentary parasites, as he calls them? What's the point of this metaphor? What's he trying to say? If you had to paraphrase it.
Just that nature sets forth a very plain set of desirable traits that we ought to not ignore as scientists or as as thoughtful human beings.
Okay, so the moral, if this was a fable, the moral of this fable that he's giving us is what for you then? Put in a sentence, like,
I can wrap it up.
I know, right?
Maybe in a sentence, what is desirable is natural. Is natural.
Good.
Common to all of us.
So, nature has many forms of desirable, and desirable is relative, is what's being said by all this. And also, variety is a spark, as a part of nature, is what's also being told. So there's no attempt to deal, to wipe out the primate part of the zoological gardens, or to get rid of, you know, the birds of prey section, or what have you. We're preserving the variety that nature makes possible. We're just trying to improve what's within that variety. So to that degree, and again, this is the mission statement by Galton, the attempt here is not to eradicate, but to reproportion, to improve, if you will. Now, what's interesting to me also is the fact that how this narrative is described, this fable, I don't know about anybody else, but I feel like it makes a rather big leap from talking to each of the different species and then saying, what is it? Though no agreement could be reached as to absolute morality, we keep saying there's no absolute morality, but I think everyone would really rather be healthy rather than sick, vigorous rather than weak, well-fitted rather than ill-fitted for their part in life. In an attempt to say that this science is not about morals, it's not determining which categories of animal or species or human are moral or immoral, those terms have been jettisoned, he thinks. But I don't think they've been jettisoned, they've just been replaced with terms like healthy and sick, vigorous and weak, well-fitted and ill-fitted. To that degree, these are terms that are supposed to be scientific, clinical, corporeal, if you will. So if we have the needs that are supposed to be met in the service of all of these issues, they are healthy, sick, what's the second one in the list? Well-fitted, or is it vigorous?
Vigorous.
Vigorous. Weak. And the last was well-fitted and ill-fitted. So, in an attempt to try to render these disciplines as being divorced or not related to these issues, that's actually something of a pipe dream, I think. For what's happened is we've changed the genre of the kind of judgment that we're making, the kind of language that we're using. But it doesn't mean that we've changed it from being any kind of moral judgment at all. Eugenics, in attempting to describe what constitutes healthy or sick, or vigorous or weak, or well-fitted or ill-fitted, has provided for us a constellation of terms that themselves are very malleable, or to some degree, culpable in some way. To that degree, healthy, vigorous, even well and ill, with the first part of those words, seem to us to describe terms that could be very precise, or at the very least grounded in thinking about the clinical, biological, corporeal sort of health of individuals. But because of the fact that eugenics is at a time where we're thinking out of public health and thinking from public hygiene, and at a time of thinking about industrialism and Darwinism and genetics, what constitutes one's healthiness, vigor, and wellness can also be not just whether or not you have a temperature or don't, are disabled or not, or have a virus or don't, but actually whether you have the background that you have, the training that you have, the work ethic that is respectable for its time, that you have the right language skill set for a particular culture and moment, that you have the right spirit of an age politically or culturally. And these things can all contribute to the social health. I mentioned down here public health being a significant factor, and that's because we're at an age now of also thinking about things of health and hygiene in terms of mental hygiene, what will become racial hygiene and sometimes referred to as social hygiene. If you remember those public health posters that we looked at from the American, the U.S. Army War Service, they are from the Department of Mental Hygiene, which is to say that this question of what is hygienic has also been expanded. To that degree, the moralistic, the ethical, even the sort of like cultural, racial, anti-Semitical sort of values that are influencing science haven't been pushed aside by eugenics, but they've been included to some degree of what these definitions of hygienic, healthy, vigorous, and well or ill actually constitute and stand for. Eugenics, in some ways, did not make possible the integration of racist beliefs into science. What science had done was expanded its definition of its very central definitions of well, health, public health, and hygiene to such a degree that it made possible a kind of eugenic sort of philosophy and practice to come into place. To that degree, as historians looking back, one of the errors we could make is to say that if we get rid of eugenics, we can fix the racist and sort of classist and sexist sort of parts of science. And that's not true. Eugenics just was one manifestation of those beliefs, because eugenics did not foster them. It was the culture of its time that made them possible. If eugenics wants to say that we can get rid of the least desirable part of the bell curve and improve the whole, one of the worst things we could do historiographically is to render eugenics to the garbage pile of medical history and think if we can get rid of it, we can fix the whole, when it's not actually the case. Please hand up for a second there. Yes.
Remind me, I'm always thinking when we do this class what somebody's going to look back at us and say, how could they? But I'm just thinking about the obesity tax. That's, I don't know if it's really in here, but sort of that push towards people who are doing things that are bringing the society down and costing the society.
There's some of that same logic, I imagine. And we could bandy about whether it's desirable or undesirable to be obese or not, but part of it is that there is an emphasis on this is for your own good, that this is also for the well-being of other people, and it's also for the fact that we want to make sure that you can be your most mobile, vigorous, vital, contributing, self-sufficient sort of person. And that kind of tax is sort of influenced by some of these values. Eugenics, of course, is significant then, not because it generated a lot of the values that seem to leave us puzzled, but that it galvanized them at a particular moment under a distinct discipline. And in the cases of, like the Buckner versus Bell case, the American Breeders Association, or in particular, the racial hygiene movement of Nazi Germany and the Third Reich, we can see that it institutionalized it and those particular attitudes in a way that's unrivaled in history. Didn't create them, and didn't provide for us the first instance or even the last instance of those kinds of scientific applications, but it certainly institutionalized them and applied them at a greater degree than we've ever seen before. Let's turn now to this page 3 of the Galton piece. My point, though, about the question of when Galton says that if we can eradicate the least desirables of the population, then let them breed amongst themselves, my question, my response would be then the term of less desirable or desirable probably was going to change. But if we got rid of everybody who had, you know, the sort of conditions for diabetes or something like that, well, then we move on to something else.
It just seems incredibly short-sighted.
Yeah. But I think that's the point about this. There's a way in which this document, like a lot of Galton's writings, are so ambitious in what they promise they can do, but also almost reserved in what they say they won't do. But they won't go on for a long period of time, or we're not going to get rid of diversity, or we're not going to try to eradicate a particular part of the population. When the hard part about eugenics is that it attempts to be at once humble and a game changer for everything at the same time. Game changer so it can seem as the most progressive form of science, and humble in a sense that doesn't feel quite as threatening to us at particular moments. Let's look quickly, though, at the 5-point breakdown that Galton provides for us here in the eugenics article, this eugenic piece. I just kind of wanted to look at what the categories he gives as the 5 points, if you will, of eugenics, and it also gives us a sense about how it's going to be applied. So the first is on page 3, number 1, dissemination of a knowledge of the laws of heredity so far as they are surely known in promotion of their further study. The big words there are heredity and dissemination. So one of the goals of eugenics, then, is to prioritize the value of hereditary science and to disseminate it. To that degree, if genetics is the discipline of the study of traits that can be passed on, eugenics is its application, if you will. So what is rendered noble or desirable or progressive about genetics in this era finds a bedfellow and finds its practical implicator in eugenics to some degree. So dissemination is one point of eugenics movement. Second is the category mentioned as historical inquiry into the rates with which the various classes of society, classified according to civic usefulness, have contributed to the population at various times in ancient and modern ways. So two is historical inquiry. That, to that degree, if eugenics provides dissemination of genetics, and number two, it also provides survey, if you will, and a survey that's also retrospectively or retroactively looking back. To that degree, it's about trying to provide a kind of savvy, if you will, for how what we can do now can be informed by what we did in the past. To that degree, historians of medicine love to study eugenics because it is its own form of historiography to some degree. Because what it's trying to do is not just chart statistical things of import during a particular contemporaneous time, but to see how those statistics in the 1920s are influenced by genetic or procreative sort of decisions that may have been made in generations prior. To that degree, that kind of survey has made it attractive to a lot of scientists at its time. Number three is on page four. Systematic collection of facts showing the circumstances under which large and thriving families have most frequently originated. In other words, the conditions of eugenics. So number three we can summarize as systematic collection. One was dissemination, two was historical inquiry, three is systematic collection. Now those two words are important because they speak to the value of the statistical analysis that is now the cornerstone of the scientific method starting in the middle of the 19th century. So eugenics speaks to the numbers game that has become so important. But also because of this part of the italicized words, conditions of eugenics. As a reformist sort of science and a progressive sort of element, what it's trying to do is absolutely effect and affect the kind of conditions socially, culturally, and socioeconomically that are made possible at a particular time, and statistically doing that. The significant thing about this emphasis on systematic collection is that it seems to us so glaring that we can look back on a lot of eugenic policy and application and see such inherent bias of what is considered valuable or not valuable, what is deemed as fit or not fit, what is deemed as feeble-minded or not. When the fact of the matter is that by using a statistical and systematic and even historical kind of analysis, there was an attempt on the part of eugenics and an acceptance on a part of a lot of popular and professional persons to think of this profession as absolutely checking any bias that it might have because it had quantifiable and systematic details with which to isolate its particular value set for what is healthy, vigorous, or well or ill-fitted. Number four is on page five, and it's just three words, influences affecting marriage. One of the things we should note that's significant at this time, too, is that the emphasis on this prenatal, this pre-procreative sort of health also put a lot of scrutiny also on marriages themselves. And marriages become significant then because for the first time really in about the beginning of the 20th century, we see the marriage as being under the umbrella, the rubric, the gaze, if you will, of the clinic. So that even though it's a civic sort of authority or sometimes even a religious one that confers this particular union, the need to have a scientific or a medical kind of approval, or even let's just say intervention into marriage laws and marriage licenses is brand new at this time and is made possible by this attention to family planning. And if family planning is now becoming a new sort of model under which it's not just the priest you need to see to about whether to have a family, and it's not just, you know, political or legal culture that needs to determine the adoption or parentage rights, but actually medicine and science that can determine the best ways with which to tackle those subjects, so marriage also falls into that particular rubric. So thus we have at the dawn of the 20th century marriage license prerequisites for things like syphilis testing or determining whether or not people are too closely related or not based on genetic studies that are probably possible for the first time. But we also see whether or not science can make a case that there should or shouldn't be interracial or interclass sort of marriages or interethnic sort of marriages. And eugenics renders possible its attentiveness to what has become a newly attentive worthy sort of subject, and that being what are the best kind of marriages and by extension best kind of families.
What do you need marriage license for today? Why do you need a marriage license?
A marriage license at this time or now?
At this time, like, so what is being checked for?
at this particular time.
No, I was leaping ahead. I'm sorry.
To our present day for a marriage license,
yeah.
There are still some lingering health requirements in some jurisdictions, but most of the ones that have tended to be more blanket and global in terms of having to have a syphilis test or that kind of thing. But there are many places where you still have to have a pregnancy test sometimes before you get a marriage license. Or there are some places that still have on the books whether you need an HIV test, whether they have a marriage license. Normally, the justification for those is not that they're going to prevent you from getting married, but they want to be sure that partners are informed of whether or not they have the full medical history. Most places don't have these laws because they're seen as infringements upon the personal privacy and rights of individuals. But there are still lingering sort of remnants of that. The importance, though, is to note in the first part of the 20th century, those kinds of medical tests and medical interventions would have been the standard, not the exception, as they are today. Yeah.
I don't know if this is fantasy or memory, but I remember a blood test that I had to take, I think, was to blood type you and let you know what your RF factor or something like that, because if I remember right, I mean, it was a non-issue.
Yeah.
Because I guess if you have a different factor, positive or minus, you can create complications in pregnancy.
Right.
So but it wasn't an issue, so it wasn't anything I really paid attention to.
It's interesting.
Talking about that, it popped up in the back of my head.
It's interesting because it varies so much based on jurisdiction, both in terms of what the region wants to justify those kinds of blood tests or any kind of medical tests before marriage, or also what it renders permissible. But it tends to be usually something, like I said, in the service of, we just want to give you more information. Not that we're actually going to have a moratorium on whether or not this marriage can happen in some way. Having said that, there were plenty of laws about medical texts, pre-marriage license, in the first half of the 20th century that were absolutely about trying to prevent. So in laws that had no interracial marriages, there were often blood tests to determine whether you had any sort of markers or any sort of genetic test that could potentially determine whether or not you were African American or not, or if you had a carrier for sickle cell, or if you could be somebody who could have, you know, Tay-Sachs disease or something. This idea that what we're going to try to do is determine whether or not this marriage can happen, not just whether or not these individuals can have all the information they need. Now, as to where it happens now and where those tests are, they tend to be at the level of trying to provide for individuals the best information they can have before they get married, and not just because they can get married, but because of the implication that they can have children together being the sort of like next logical step to that sort of theory. But you can see even in the justifications we provide today for why a kind of medical test that the state and medicine would want to be invested in whether or not people have children or get married, the implication being that they could have children, you can see some of the same logic and groundwork that made possible eugenics as it expanded and proliferated in the first part of the 20th century. The big thing to note is, of course, that we constantly are checking our very suspicion and tendency to want to test and intervene medically at a moment like a marriage license, based on these lessons we've learned in the past from something like what eugenics had wrought in many ways in the first half of the 20th century. Yeah, Dick?
Although if you actually read today the opinion, like the Irish Supreme Court opinion on gender-blind marriage, what they said there was that there was really not a health issue. The reason why you need marriage licenses is because you're creating a contract, and therefore the state's going to force that contract, so that you have to have a document from the state to say that the contract exists.
Yeah, and this is the hard part about when we think about same-sex marriages now, or we think about these marriage licenses that had back then. What is the implication? Not just in writing the explicit name, but what's the implication for why a state has a vested interest in a marriage? Is it to condone, you know, a union between people? Is it because it's a kind of contract? Is it, as these marriage license laws and prerequisites and eugenic interests show, is that marriage equals the next step, which is having a family? And the truth of the matter is, you know, people say that, you know, same-sex marriage is changing the definition of marriage. I mean, the answer to that is, of course, that the marriage definition constantly keeps changing, I mean, even within a particular period of time, because it is so complex, it has served so many implications and functions at a particular moment. And the one you mentioned about the Iowa case shows the way in which it was reworded or rephrased, and the eugenic interest is absolutely on the side of what is the procreative sort of value. But then again, eugenics is almost always looking at every subject and thinking, what is the procreative sort of eugenic sort of value at this particular moment? And let's see here. The last thing up here of significance is number 5. Persistence in setting forth the national importance of eugenics. Now, this is where we get policies, where we get racial hygiene, where we get Third Reich and Nazi sort of science. That what eugenics is starting as is trying to say in its very nascence, let's think about the prenatal care of individuals and mothers-to-be and babies that are on the way. And then it moves towards, let's think about what we can do the best for a particular family and its family planning. And then it expands to, what can we do to best preserve the value of a culture? a neighborhood, a community, a city, an area, so that we're not out resourcing too many resources, that we're not having too many criminals in a particular area, that we're not being taxed by having too many feeble-minded individuals in one particular jurisdiction or space. And then it expands, and as it's said here, made explicit that we're not just getting bigger because we're moving from small families or individuals to regions to nations, but that in an invocation of national, what we're doing that is attaching a whole set of values and a value set towards a science that says it's in the best interest of one's own nationhood as a character to invoke this particular science. Why this is significant is that the nation state as a category anthropologically exists as far back as like the damn Mesopotamians and shit, right? But the notion of the nation as being the central organizer of not just geography but political entities across the globe really comes into its, you know, apex in the 20th century. It's why we had still in the 19th century, you know, the Victorian Empire or the Ottoman Empire or some other sort of kingdom or dynasty, or that it's really in the 20th century that we start to think about how can we organize regions, races, ethnicities, cultures, populations by extension, into nations. And by granting them nations, we give them delineation, we give them political agency, and we give them a kind of authentication. Now, if eugenics is selling itself, and one of its five principles being in the service of national importance, and nation being the big word, eugenics is not only the science of the 20th century that is the way to quantify genetics and biology, but it's also the way that's in the service of organizing and structuring your very nation itself. Therefore feeding right back into the political, the economic, and the social factors that made possible eugenics in the first place. To that degree, what lays the groundwork for eugenics? Eugenics promises to double back and expand and improve tenfold on its own right. To that degree, eugenics is not something that shoehorned itself at a particular moment historically, but almost threaded itself into the values, categories, and methodologies that are really the cornerstone of the early part of the 20th century, politically, economically, and socially. And it just happened that under the rubrics of science and medicine, eugenics came across as shiny star, like the science to make that possible. Any questions about Galton? All right, let's take a look quickly at this short piece by Max Nordau. We're not going to look at it long. I just kind of wanted you to have it more than anything. Yeah, did you have a question?
But I'm curious. When you read the comments after the paper, though, most of the audience seemed to be not very happy with
it. Yeah, yeah, and it was sort of...
And he said, well, your audience.
Yeah.
But I mean, but was it received eventually by these people?
Oh, but the people in the audience?
Yeah.
Those individuals, probably not. The important thing to note, by the way, is that what is so damning about German applications of eugenics is not just the way in which they were taken to such extreme measures, which they were, but let's also not forget, too, that there's genocide happening in many places throughout the world, and at that time were happening as well. What's so, and I say this in a not inflated way, but impressive about eugenics in Germany is the way in which it was so impressive that so many persons were willing to not just come on board with the eugenics movement in Germany in the 1930s and early 1940s, but they were willing to not object to it to some degree. So in the United States, in Britain, there was a very divisive sort of feel for what eugenics could provide certain disciplines and certain sciences and certain political entities. And in Germany, it's just that there was a way in which it made possible the integration of the structure of a particular political climate at the time. So the objections that you see at the end of this article, the one from the speech from Galton, are not atypical. In fact, they're almost kind of stereotypical in terms of what the kinds of objections are and how severe or heated that they are. To that degree, what made eugenics kind of interesting, too, is that in its very progressive, sort of broad sort of mindset, it also got people riled up and excited to some degree. What I want to do, though, is see a cornerstone of eugenics right now. This is the piece from Degeneration by Max Nordau. Nordau is a famous sociologist and criminologist and also sort of like cultural theorist working at the turn of the 20th century, so the very end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. One thing I really wanted you to note from this, what we're just going to look at very briefly, is that what degeneration is. Degeneration is the theory that there are certain categories and qualities that we can ascribe and describe as being not worthy or not ideal in a particular climate or culture. And the point of degeneracy is that it's expanding, that those things don't have to just be conditions or illnesses or debilitating diseases or disabilities, but they can also be conditions like criminality or criminal propensity, sexual deviance, or potential tendencies for things like gambling or the inability to keep a job or alcoholism. mean, it's in many ways a debate that's happening at the beginning of the 20th century in degeneration theory that's not unlike the genetic kind of testing that we have now, trying to determine a whole host of other categories besides the obvious biological ones you think of. Is there a genetic marker for left-handedness? Is there a genetic marker for homosexuality? Is there a genetic marker for whether or not you like sweets? Is there a genetic marker for whether or not you gamble or not? That sort of thing. Degeneration provided the same discourse that was happening, a lexicon with which to organize all of that around. Now, one thing I want you to note is on page 2 of this in the back, this book by Max Nordau is dedicated to Cesar Lombroso. Cesar Lombroso, I don't know if I mentioned it to you a couple weeks ago, is very famous because he's the most famous criminologist and phrenologist of the early 20th century. So what Lombroso did was he took all of that scientific theory from the 19th century about brain localization theory, and he applied it to criminality. So the longevity of phrenology, and I told you it got very suspect and poo-pooed by the end of the 19th century, lingered into the 20th century in the way that it could promise to isolate and eradicate criminal tendencies in certain populations. Lombroso's value then, or his important values then, were statistical analysis and the application of reform towards the eradications of certain populations. To that end, Nordau's work, degeneration theory, comes off of the work of a late-stage phrenologist to try to think about how can we not just identify criminal or debased sort of tendency, but how can we also categorize in a large way, in a very large, significant way, the significant values, not just criminality, that speak to what's undesirable to a particular culture. And eugenics, coming off of degeneration theory, makes possible the idea of how we can put those things into practice. To that end, eugenics claims that genetics is what it comes out of, that eugenics is genetics put into practice. But what eugenics actually is degeneration theory put into practice, made possible by genetics and other ideas at the time. But it's the very category of judgments that come with degeneration theory that make possible eugenic ideas. Let's look really briefly at this is the third page here. I just want to take you to one paragraph. This is the dedication to Cesar Lombroso. I'm just going to read the first couple of paragraphs to hear what a little bit of this philosophy of degeneration sounds like and how you can see that the spirit of it is really what galvanizes, what really puts the winds in the sail of eugenics. And he writes to Lombroso, Dear and honored master, I dedicate this book to you in open and joyful recognition of the fact that without your labors it could never have been written. The notion of degeneracy, first introduced to the science of morale and developed with so much genius by yourself, has in your hands already shown itself extremely fertile in the most diverse directions. On numerous obscure points of psychiatry, criminal law, politics, and sociology, you have poured a veritable flood of light, which those alone have not perceived, who obdurately close their eyes, who are too short-sighted to derive benefit from any enlightenment whatsoever. But there is a vast and important domain into which neither you nor your disciples have hitherto borne the touch of your method, the domain of art and literature. Degenerates are not always criminals, prostitutes, anarchists, and pronounced lunatics. They are often authors and are artists. These, however, manifest the same mental characteristics, and for the most part the same somatic features, as the members of the above-mentioned anthropological family, who satisfy their unhealthy impulses with the knife of the assassin or the bomb of the dynamiter, instead of with pen and pencil. Some among these degenerates in literature, music, and painting have in recent years come into extraordinary prominence and are revered by numerous admirers as creators of a new art and heralders of the coming centuries. This phenomenon is not to be disregarded. Books and works of art exercise a powerful suggestion on the masses. It is from these productions that an age derives its ideals of morality and beauty. If they are absurd and antisocial, they exert a disturbing and corrupting influence on the views of a whole generation. I'm going to stop there and read those last two sentences again because it provides for us what's significant about degeneration theory and what it lends itself to eugenics. This bell curve that's talked about here. And by the way, everybody remembers that book, The Bell Curve, that came out? Do you remember that book? It was about 1994, 1995, that was done by a Harvard sociologist, political scientist, and biologist, I think, that was about trying to chart statistically who has the greatest likelihood to be athletic, high blood pressure, make a good living, have a high IQ, and what it tried to do in bell curves was to chart, this is where your race or this is where your sect is. And when it came out, it was highly controversial. Does anybody remember this, the bell curve, the book that came out? Yeah. Which is to say that the point of that is that the bell curve didn't generate that kind of racist sort of statistical analysis, but neither did eugenics either. But what each of those moments, one at the beginning and one at the end of the 20th century, provided were frameworks with which to articulate what are enduring sort of desires on the part of many people in science, politics, medicine, to want to quantify what are otherwise cultural or moral sort of characteristics, or even economic sort of characteristics and qualities. This article here, this dedication by Nordo, says so as well. And it does so in trying to isolate and identify what are at the extremes of this bell curve. And what he's saying is that there are two sides of the same coin. Read the last two sentences again. Books and works of art are a powerful suggestion on the masses. It is from these productions that an age derives its ideals of morality and beauty. If they are absurd and antisocial, they exert a disturbing and corrupting influence on the views of a whole generation. Eugenics' attempt, like degeneration theory's aims articulated here, is to make sure that the influence of these persons or their works of art or their byproducts in any way do or don't have a corrupting influence. The language that's being used here, this emphasis on corrupting influence, is really the motivation that's behind eugenics. And what eugenics wants to do is to say, let's not let these individuals have a corrupting influence, or have any kind of influence, if you will, on the stature or the quality of our population, our breed, our society. What eugenics is saying, because eugenics is about putting into practice these things, is let eugenics have the influence, if you will. Eugenics gets a rap as a theory, but what it is an application and an attempt to have an influence where there's the fear invoked of where someone else could have the influence, whether that's in appropriation or race or economics or culture, if you will. Any questions? I like to look at the Buck versus Doe case. Maybe that's the last thing we do. This is a kind of American example. We've looked a little bit at the British now, some of the German we talked about. And Nordo, by the way, was German. His work on generation theory, so it had a very large influence in Germany and America. But I thought we could just read out loud some of the text from here to get a sense about a political, legal sort of application of some of this eugenic sort of theory, and in particular as it's applied towards sterilization or anti-sterilization laws. It is noted, and as it was mentioned in the documentary, it really is in a couple of major categories that we see eugenic theory applied quite often to notions of sterilization laws. Those tend to be ones dealing with mental faculties and capabilities, or mental retardations, that they would have been called at the time, disabilities of various mental and physical kinds, immigration statuses, whether or not to allow certain persons to emigrate into a country is also contingent upon whether they also get to procreate when they come into this country. There would have been a big distinction made between those two rights or possibilities. Yes, you can come and be a citizen of the United States, but no, you cannot come here and have children of your own. Those would have been two distinct rights as they were understood. The third would have been racial or ethnic sort of breakdowns that would have happened. And the fourth would have been ones having to do, these are with sterilization laws, with criminality. And by criminality, I also include the notion of one's own economic viability. So whether or not somebody was the subject of a debt collector or the subject of also being hunted down by somebody because of a crime or an outstanding warrant, those would have been individuals that we would have wanted to not tax the resources of a culture on. So those categories influence what are these sterilization laws, especially in the United States at the time. But let's look at this one, Buck versus Bell. Carrie Buck is the person that we're talking about here, who was mentioned in the documentary, somebody who was feeble-minded, as she was described at the time, who became pregnant as the result of a rape, I think, and that she was going to have a child, and there was a question about whether could we have prevented this to happen in some degree. Let's look at the second paragraph on here. It's on the case, Supreme Court case from 1926. Did we have this? Buck versus Bell? Okay, I'm just going to read it out loud if you don't have it. And this is the words as described by the majority opinion. It's Justice Butler. Well, that's the dissenter. Who's the writer of this here? Justice Holmes. Here we go. Carrie Buck is a feeble-minded white woman who was committed to the state colony above mentioned in due form. She is the daughter of a feeble-minded mother in the same institution and the mother of an illegitimate feeble-minded child. She was 18 years old at the time of the trial of her case in the circuit court in the latter part of 1924. An act of Virginia approved March 20th, 1924, recites that the health of the patient and the welfare of society, notice here that these notions of what constitutes health, vigor, well or ill-fitted, here are being understood. What's being weighed here is, what is the health of an individual? What is the health of a society in that particular way? The expansion of the question of healthiness has changed. The health of the patient, the welfare of a society, may be promoted in certain cases by the sterilization of mental defectives under careful safeguard, etc. That the sterilization may be effected in males by vasectomy and in females by, can somebody pronounce that?
Self-injectomy,
without serious pain or substantial danger to life. That the Commonwealth is supporting in various institutions many defective persons who, if now discharged, would become a menace, but if incapable of procreating, might be discharged with safety and become self-supporting with benefit to themselves and to society. And that experience has shown that heredity plays an important part in the transmission of insanity, imbecility, etc. The statute then enacts that whenever the superintendent of certain institutions, including the above-named state colony, shall be of opinion that it is for the best interests of the patients and of society that an inmate under his care should be sexually sterilized, he may have the operation performed upon any patient afflicted with hereditary forms of insanity, imbecility, etc., on complying with the very careful provisions by which the Act protects the patients from possible abuse. Now again, this weighing between the health of the society and the health of the individual, the protection of the individual versus the protection of us all, the viability, what's the phrase used, the person can be self-supporting to some degree. We can see the kind of influences that are determining the very shifty sort of way with which we can understand this particular term healthy as it applies to the socioeconomic and also to the sort of, like in this case, mental, but one can say more largely clinical needs of the individual. Turning to page 3 up here, I want to read sort of what's the summation paragraph. It's the penultimate one, but it's the kicker, if you will, for this case of Buck versus Bell. It writes on page 3, "The attack is not upon the procedure, but upon the substantive law. It seems to me contended that in no circumstances could such an order be justified. Certainly it is contended that the order cannot be justified upon the existing grounds. The judgment finds the facts that have been recited and that Carrie Buck is the probable potential parent of socially inadequate offspring, I'm quoting here, likewise afflicted, that she may be sexually sterilized without determinant to her general health, and that her welfare and that of society will be promoted by her sterilization, and thereupon makes the order. In view of the general declarations of the legislature and the specific findings of the court, obviously we cannot say, as a matter of law, that the grounds do not exist, and if they exist, they justify the result. We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices, often not felt to be such by those concerned, in order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence. It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes." Jacobson versus Massachusetts, in other words, a comparable matter being made here. Whereas it's summarized here, three generations of imbeciles are enough. It's probably the most famous line that's made possible in this case. Yeah, very definitive. The idea being that there's already pause or hesitation or reservation on the part of the majority opinion writer here about maybe this law does have things that infringe upon the liberties of individuals, whether they be genetic or just legal in some degree. But the justifications, the rewards that come from this particular procedure seem to outweigh. To that degree, eugenics is longevity, its viability, the period that it had significance and it had prominence in science, did not come without objection and did not come without reservation on the parts of a whole host of politicians, economists, social theorists, medical persons, scientists, and clinicians. They all did. But what outweighed those reservations was the promise, the application, and to some degree the greater good that public health and public hygiene and social hygiene in some ways rendered those reservations to be silenced in some ways. Yeah.
Where was the church on this religion? Where did religion stand?
Yeah, it's not unlike law and science and medicine that you could find proponents of it and those who are against it at the same time. So a lot of religious persons were quite supportive at the way of preserving family planning and the best sorts of families, the advocation for eugenics sort of theory. So that it's not unlike, you know, today when we see, you know, marriage laws and same-sex marriage laws talked about, you know, religious persons often feel very invested. And the reason they feel invested is because they feel invested in the family as a category, a construct.
Catholicism, for example, would be opposed to cutting off
means
of procreation.
Yes, they would. And the way that they would have this hardline rule about not preventing contraception, and yet the values that influence eugenics, the kind of way in which it gives a prominence to the family, and the way that it wants to preserve the sanctity of the family and the marriage by extension, would have been very attractive to Catholics at the time. How that, what the specific applications of eugenics would have been, would have probably been bones of contention. But the theories behind eugenics would have spoken a great deal to sort of Catholic theorists at the time. Any other thoughts on this eugenics and this discourse? It's a topic I wanted us to end on in many ways, because I think it is, you know, historically and temporally sort of a perfect fitting to end, if you do end up taking the class next semester that Art's teaching on the history of bioethics, because really what happens as a result of eugenics is that it makes possible the Third Reich, it makes possible the Holocaust or the Shoah, and to that end, what makes possible then are the war crimes tribunals that really come out as a result of that, to say, let's, in the courts now, actually hold accountable not just the persons who committed war crimes in the name of politics, but also in the names of science and medicine, and most of those using eugenics in particular. What it made possible then were the Nuremberg trials and what would eventually become the Nuremberg Codes of Human Rights, which, for those of you who don't know, it's the cornerstone of bioethics and medical ethics, such that medical ethics and medical concerns of different sort of ethical sort of varieties have been around since, you know, classical medicine, but the attempt and the need to want to codify, write down, and render precise what those ethical sort of values are that are the cornerstone of medical ethics are what really this notion of eugenics really made possible. Eugenics, to that degree, is not an anomaly, but it's a culmination, if you will, of enduring questions of change and continuity, as we talked about this semester, progress and regression, tradition and innovation that seem to be different and competing values at times, but really as a form of application is what eugenics is, the promise that it offered. But the dangerous ways which it was applied, ironically, created great death and destruction and the infringement upon many great rights, but ironically provided really the discourse for medical ethics and bioethics that have been a long time coming. What I wanted to do was end right now by having us look at the Hippocratic Oath, which is what we started with at the beginning of the semester. And to that end, I wanted to read it out loud. And I wanted to read it out loud to hear, again, some of those concerns we heard at the beginning of the semester, to have us hear it now. And I want you to think about, as I read it, just some of the issues we've talked about this semester. Eugenics today, the rise of the clinic and the teaching hospital, the concerns about the clinical gaze and the perspective and citizenhood of an individual, the medical marketplace as it came to prominence and how it sort of changed about whether or not a person has agency in the clinic as a patient to buy and sell or trade or see a second opinion. That movement that Juicen talked about from bedside medicine to hospital medicine to laboratory medicine, or now we see it proliferating even more so. And that amongst all of these different historical periods and these changes and continuities, there has been really from its nascence, you know, bioethics and medical ethics and clinical ethics at its heart, but never so clearly, so definitively articulated. Those who study medical history beyond where we've reached and those who take art class will find that now medical ethics and clinical ethics is precisely, explicitly, and deliberately articulated. And yet, in looking back over the periods we've discussed, you'll see that it's there all the while. And so I wanted to end by reading the Hippocratic Oath, which is the text that hovers over all of this and informs where bioethics goes from here. So here's the Hippocratic Oath. I swear by Apollo, physician, by Eclepsius, by Help, by Panacea, by all the gods and goddesses, making them my witnesses, that I will carry out, according to my ability and judgment, this oath and this indenture, to hold my teacher in this art equal to my own parents, to make him partner in my livelihood, when he is in need of money, to share mine with him, to consider his family as my own brothers, and to teach them this art if they want to learn it without fee or indenture, to impart precept or instruction, and all other instruction to my own sons, the sons of my teacher, and to indentured pupils who have taken the physician's oath, but to nobody else. I will use treatment to help the sick according to my ability and judgment, but never with a view to injury and wrongdoing. Neither will I administer a poison to anybody when asked to do so, nor will I suggest such a course. Similarly, I will not give to a woman a pessary to cause abortion, but I will keep pure and holy both my life and my art. I will not use the knife, not even barely, on sufferers from stone, but I will give place to such as are craftsmen therein. Into whatsoever houses I enter, I will enter to help the sick, and I will abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm, especially from abusing the bodies of man or woman, bond or free. And whatsoever I shall see or hear in the course of my profession, as well as outside my profession in my intercourse with men, if it be what should not be published abroad, I will never divulge, holding such things to be holy secrets. Now if I carry out this oath and break it not, may I gain forever reputation among all men for my life and for my art. But if I transgress it and forswear myself, may the opposite befall me. Thanks for a great semester, everybody. Again, if you're interested in the field trip, Shelly, give her an email.
Shelly.
All right.